So the age-old tension is one of the issues that we currently have with the Lambda CDM standard cosmological model. I'm going to give you a brief introduction to it. I can't go into all of the possible ways in which it can be resolved, but I'm going to try to tell you about some of them. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about sample variance and patch-to-patch variations in the universe, which is one of the ways that with the postdoc, Zheng Zhuzai, he's now actually faculty in Shanghai, how we actually contributed ever so slightly to not understanding this tension. Okay. Now, is this going to work? It's not going to work. Okay, possibly because I just dropped it. Okay, so the Hubble measurements have a long history of incorrect measurements. This is not at all being fair to Hubble, but the data that he plotted in 1929, he had distances on the x-axis of his plot. No, I really have just killed that. On the x-axis of his plot, yeah, thankfully. Oh yeah, and thankfully I'm extremely tall as well. So, on the x-axis, distance, on the y-axis, velocity of galaxies moving away from us. The Hubble parameter is obviously the gradient. Unfortunately for the distances that Hubble inferred for these galaxies, he was out by a factor of 7, and that meant that the Hubble parameter he measured was not the 70 that we think it is today in units of kilometers per second per megaparsec, but was actually 7 times that, around 500. That's not to diminish what he did, because basically this is the standard thing that all scientists, observational scientists at least, should do. You take some data, you plot it, you fit a straight line, and you show there's a wonderful trend, which showed, in this case, an incredibly exciting result that the universe is expanding. So Q moving forwards nearly 100 years, and we now have more accurate measurements of the gradient of this plot. And this is a wonderfully scientific way of presenting it, which is the measurements of H naught versus year of publication. And you can see that basically for this decade, everybody was fine. Measurements from Supernova Key Project, early measurements from cosmic microwave background, I'm going to talk a little bit more about how these measurements happen, were all in agreement. And then at around 2014, 2015, unfortunately, there was a split, and it was a split not just in terms of groups, but in terms of methods, and the local measurements using supernova and the more large-scale measurements using the cosmic microwave background particularly diverged in this way. And the significance of this difference is about 5 sigma.
I'm going to talk about the thickness of red.
Yeah, I will talk about that later. So this plot, which was produced by one of the supernova teams, is perhaps not completely fair because it is a little bit selective in the data it plots. So if I squeeze this down, this is the same data but just squashed down, which enables me to use all of my PowerPoint skills to plot another set compilation of data on this plot where I've tried to match 60 and 80. But this gives you a more complete picture of the sort of measurements that were happening. And just by eye, which is never a good thing to do, but you can kind of see that a lot of people were kind of ambitious in the error bars that they gave on their measurements. Even so, this still shows that there is this basically difference that we see to date. Okay. So the key thing is actually not just these are different groups now who have different systematics, but these are different styles of measurement. This is a local measurement. This is a more large-scale measurement, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later. And so this perhaps introduces a question as to whether this could be telling us something about cosmology. Maybe on very large scales, this is right, but locally, this is right, and maybe no observer has made a mistake. Maybe what we're seeing here is actually something to do with the universe. It's telling us something very interesting. Okay, So let's go through some of the methods that are used to measure H naught. Let's look at the local measurements. And H naught is an absolute quantity in the universe. It is not a relative quantity. It is an absolute value of something. And absolute values are always more difficult to measure. Relative values are always cleaner in general when you're doing observations. So if you want to measure the baryon density in the universe compared to the radiation density, that is something you can actually measure reasonably easily. But if you want to know the absolute quantity, like for H naught, that's typically a lot harder. So to measure H naught, you have to start with something absolute. You have to start with an absolute measurement in the universe. You can start with the Sun-Earth distance. If you've measured that in some other way, you can start with a period that you know. You can start with, for example, masers, where you know the acceleration that's happening within those objects. But all measurements of H naught must start with some absolute calibrator. What you then do is you use relative calibration to push these measurements. Typically, the absolute measurements you can only do locally, like really locally, like Sun-Earth locally. But you need to look at a patch of the universe that is sufficiently large that you think it should be expanding with the background expansion. So you can use, for example, Cepheid variables or the tip of the red giant branch. And these are ways of pushing out. So if you have a galaxy where you observe a maser, and a Cepheid variable, and you can use the acceleration in the maser to get a distance to that galaxy, but you also had a Cepheid variable in that galaxy, then you can use that distance that you've measured with the maser to calibrate the luminosity period relationship in the Cepheids, and then you can push out to other galaxies where you don't have masers and you only have Cepheids. And this is the sort of way that the distance ladder is built up. You start off with absolute calibrators. You use galaxies that have one of these absolute calibrators and a relative calibrator in common. And then you basically take another step out because you need to go to supernova 1A because they are the objects that are standardizable candles and that you can see out to a sufficiently large volume that you think you should be looking at a patch of the universe that's expanding with the background expansion.
So how large is sufficiently large? Like, where are these Cepheids that are used?
Ooh, that's a really good question. That's the second half of my talk, because that's sample variance.
But okay.
No, that's good. It justifies the way I've laid out the talk. Okay, so absolute calibrator, calibrate a relative calibrator locally, use that in turn to calibrate a relative calibrator that can match the supernova, and then you get a cosmological volume. That's the basic plan. Pictorially, here's a galaxy, here's a star I've drawn on it, again using extremely good PowerPoint skills. This, for example, if you could also see a maser, would be a calibrated galaxy. This would be in your sample as a distance that's known and used to calculate the supernova, and then you'd go off and you'd observe supernova happening in distant galaxies, and you would basically use the difference between the absolute and apparent magnitudes to measure the distance of the galaxy, and from that get H naught.
Is it possible to say, without wasting your time, how a maser is used to find a distance?
Probably, but not by me. Okay. So that's one way of building out from us locally to observe a volume of the universe that we can actually, from building out from us to further distances, build out cosmological expansion. One of the other ways for measuring the Hubble parameter is to use the cosmic microwave background. The absolute quantity that is measured in this case is the temperature of the CMB. That, because we know the CMB is black body, gives us the physical energy density in radiation. And then the measurements of the CMB power spectrum tell us, for example, the physical baryon density compared to that radiation density. And we can plug in the radiation density from the black body formula and get out omega BH squared, omega CH squared, and so on. One of the quantities that all of these data constrain then is the Hubble parameter, and it is tied to the model that you use for the other parameters. But if you just look at a flat lambda CDM model, the way that it's tied is actually reasonably clean. And the idea is that almost all of the CMB constraints, or at least the tightest of the CMB constraints, comes from the observed angular position of this first peak. This is the thing that, looking at the CMB, you measure most accurately. It's basically where that peak is. The physical position of that peak depends on omega m h squared and omega b h squared. And then we see it projected by the angular diameter distance to the last scattering surface. That brings in a different combination of omega m and h. And together, the position of the first peak gives a degeneracy between the Hubble parameter and the matter density of around omega m h to the 3.4 or so. And if you can break that degeneracy, you can measure the Hubble parameter. And the relative heights of these peaks does do that for the CMB alone, particularly when you bring in polarization. And for the latest Planck results, this degeneracy between omega m and h naught is broken here at about h naught of 68 or so. If you want to tie this kind of h naught measurement to the local h naught measurement, what it is very similar, but instead of looking to distances to calibrated galaxies in a local patch, you're looking at the distance to the last scattering surface, and you're using the CMB as your known quantity that should give you that scale that you can then use as a, basically as a, not a standard candle, but a standard ruler. Okay, and I just want to talk about one further technique, which is called Big Bang Nuclear Synthesis plus BAO. So you don't need the CMB to do this finding a standard ruler. You can use the Baran acoustic oscillation peak in a galaxy survey. So that same physics that created the cosmic microwave background also tells you where you should find galaxies in the universe, the statistical distribution of galaxies. And so if you look at a galaxy survey, you find that there are preferentially pairs of galaxies separated by 100 megaparsec compared to pairs of galaxies separated by 80 megaparsec or by 120 megaparsec. This gives you a standard ruler, but the position of the ruler depends on the baryon density, the matter density, and the Hubble parameter. So you can't, from this ruler, without extra information, understand what H is. But if you use Big Bang Nuclear Synthesis, Big Bang Nuclear Synthesis tells you the baryon to photon ratio. Because of the CMB temperature, we know what that photon density is. And so we can get out from Big Bang Nuclear Synthesis the physical baryon density. That is enough to break this degeneracy between these three parameters when we analyze the data across and along the line of sight, and to measure H naught. And here's an example of a project where we did this. This was the extended baryon oscillation spectroscopic survey. This was the distance ladder constraints of H naught around 74. The CMB constraints are here, H naught around 68, and then these are the Big Bang Nuclear Synthesis plus BAO constraints. So it's not just a difference between CMB and local universe distance ladder measurements. It's also, if you put in BAO plus BBN, then you also get actually an H naught, which is similar to the CMB information. The local measurements, they do differ in terms of exactly how you do the intermediate step of the calibration. So not just saying, here's the absolute measurements, but saying, how do we then go out to the supernova? Do we use Cepheids? Do we use the tip of the red giant branch? This makes a little bit of difference as to how you measure H naught.
Sorry, did you say BBN alone? Does that give you any measure?
No, BBN alone just gives you the baryon density. And then when you tie it together with this peak that you can observe in the galaxy surveys, mm-hmm. that is enough to basically tell you where that peak should be, and then you can use that peak as a projection to measure the distance to the galaxy surface.
But the CMB peak doesn't require BBN?
No, it doesn't. There's enough information here to also, to basically constrain omega BH squared and omega CH squared together.
Yeah. So they're fully independent, those two?
Yes. Yeah.
Fully, that's what I was getting at, because the B baryon acoustic oscillation is just a descendant of the structure in the CMB.
They're independent observations, but of the same physical process. Can I get away with that wording? And I'll talk about that because that's one of the ways that people want to solve the Hubble parameter, is to change that physical process. Okay. So this is pretty much the current state of affairs. Nobody really understands why these are all different. Okay. There is a general, you know, these are all pretty similar measurements, except they're different scales. You need an absolute measurement. You need to theoretically link that to an observed physical quantity. That means you need to have the physics of BBN, CMB, BAO positions. And then you make projected distance observations. And then basically you measure H naught. It's all over 100 years, we're doing exactly what Hubble was doing. We're measuring redshifts. We're measuring distances. We've got some object we think we understand with the physical theory. And we're measuring H naught. 100 years of progress. Okay. And there we are. Right. So, this is a problem in cosmology. Any of the components that go into how these measurements are made could be wrong. And because the astronomy community consists of a lot of people trying to find something interesting to do, there are hundreds of papers on pretty much every aspect that could have gone wrong. I'm only going to consider a very small subset of potential solutions. Late universe changes, I'll show you why they don't work. Early dark energy, which some people think is the best, most promising theory at the moment. And I'm going to talk about cosmic variance, because that's the bit that I did that didn't actually work. So here is a plot now of the measured Hubble parameter in slightly different units against redshift. The supernova are often portrayed as being a measurement at redshift zero, which is where we basically normalize these distances. But it's worth bearing in mind that all of these distance measurements happen at a range of redshifts. So these are the BAO constraints, and you can see they are at redshift 0.5, redshift 1.5, redshift 2. If you want to change the Hubble parameter by doing something at low redshift, you have to be very careful about what you are doing. You can't just move everything up without also moving the data up. You can't put in a different slope here to try and get up to here at least these redshifts. And if you try to do it by changing the slope really locally, you have to remember that even the supernova measurements are not that local. So this is an example from a paper I found where they were trying to do this. They put in a functional form that they'd presumably pulled out of a hat, giving them a slope, which basically at this point, redshifts of 0.1, pushed out to the Riesertal measurement value. And it basically messed up all of their distance redshift constraints from supernova. Basically, the whole distance ladder broke down. That's why it's actually very difficult to solve the Hubble tension with a cosmological model that brings in extra acceleration or extra expansion, at least, at low redshifts. It just doesn't work because we have data not just at redshift zero, but a whole range of redshifts that you have to fit with your proposed solution. So that's, I think, why people think early dark energy, at least theoretically, is perhaps one of the ways to go. An early dark energy is an extra period of acceleration that happens after matter radiation equality. You don't mess up Big Bang nuclear synthesis or anything. It happens before recombination, so you don't mess up the late time universe and CMB production. But what it does is it actually decreases the sound horizon. So it physically changes the position of the peaks in both the galaxy survey and the cosmic microwave background, moving them to smaller scales such that when you see them on the sky, they're projected to a different distance and you get a different Hubble parameter.
So when you say early period of acceleration,
yeah.
Is it like it was temporary?
It was temporary, that's a good yes. So here is the fraction of energy density that's required in this early dark energy for these models. It peaks around 0.1, so it's not dominant. And it has to, you know, it can sit there and just be discovered at this point, but it has to decay and go away. And so the equation of state has to change to something. And whatever it changes to can actually change the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, as well as shifting it in scale. So you don't just take the cosmic microwave background and move it in scale because you've got this change in the sound horizon. You actually do affect the fluctuations in a more complicated way based on what this dark energy, this early dark energy decays into. And so here's a plot from a summary paper that came out not too long ago showing a range of early dark energy models, which pretty much all differ in exactly the shape of the peak and exactly what they decay into. At the end of it, they all roughly need a peak fraction of early dark energy at a redshift of around 3000, that's around 10% of the energy density. They all roughly give a larger H0 value from the cosmic microwave background, because fundamentally they're changing the sound horizon. But they're all fighting against this fact that not only are they changing the sound horizon, they're also changing the fluctuations, and the Planck CMB data, look incredibly like a Lambda CDM model. So there's a limit to how many extra fluctuations you can put in here caused by whatever the early dark energy decays into, without messing up the chi-squared of the fit.
Sorry to interrupt, is that the reason they can't get up to H0 at 73?
Pretty much, there's always a balance, right? Mm-hmm. They want to put in enough early dark energy to push H0 higher, but they don't want to put in so much that the CMB delta chi-squared really goes down. Mm-hmm. And so this final panel that they have shows that, which is basically the balance between improving the delta chi-squared with the H0 measurement compared to making it worse by having the CMB look different. And it's all horrendously model dependent. You can see that from the number of models concluded here. And all of those models, they have different numbers of parameters that are then marginalized over in different ways in this kind of Bayesian analysis, and it all gets horribly messy.
You call them dark energy. So are you assuming the equation of state is always?
The equation of state starts off at -1 and then it decays to something else.
Does anybody just simply fit the curve, a scale factor as a function of time, and just optimize the fit?
Yeah, we don't have the data for that. You have to have parameterized it in some way and be constraining those parameters.
You could fit perfectly all the data if you allow yourself to vary a of t however you wanted?
At these early times, if you could basically only change the sound horizon. There are some slight caveats about what else you're changing in terms of how you're doing it, but pretty much, yeah, that's a broad brush picture. Ghazal?
Oh, sorry, what's the red and what's the blue?
The red and the blue are the differences between how the delta chi squared is improved, and I think, and I wish in this plot, if I was the supervisor of whoever did this work, I would have told them to change these labels to also match red and blue, and that would have helped me now. But I think I can't actually remember. I think the blue is the supernova improvement and the red is the CMB improvement, but don't quote me on that.
Different zeros.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah.
It's a naive question, but how is this different to an inflationary scenario?
In many ways, it's not. You have to have a period of acceleration, or you have to increase the change of the scale factor at these times, and then you have to have it stop at some point.
Okay.
So, it's much later than inflation.
Yeah, it's much later than inflation. I mean, in broad brush picture, it's another period of inflation.
But, do you have to add in another scalar field?
Yeah. And have it come in at specifically the time you want it to do, and have it decay in a way that doesn't kill other things. So it's quite contrived.
But you want two inflations, two periods of inflation. Like it doesn't.
Well, we already have two because we have late time dark energy. So this is a third. So at some point, nobody worries about adding in more, right? If you've got, you know, two, another one is.
So I've lost sight of it. So this burst of acceleration that is ad hoc, does it keep shoes and change CMB or keep CMB and change shoes?
It keeps shoes and changes CMB. So it mainly changes the sound horizon. So your physical position of your CMB peaks is changed.
Nice.
And then the projected distance has to change to give you H0.
And totally ad hoc, just to give the answer
yes.
you want.
Yes.
Is it that H0 really was bigger at the time of CMB, or that we were fooled into thinking it's bigger because we missed the change in the sound horizon?
Okay. So what this does is it actually This increases the Hubble parameter at recombination when the CMB is produced, and that decreases the sound horizon. Because the sound horizon is basically CS over H at recombination, speed of sound over the Hubble parameter at recombination, which is how far this spherical wave can get fighting against the expansion of the universe. When you basically translate now that RS to the projected position of the CMB. The projected position of the CMB is a physical angle that is fixed, but it basically is RS over the distance to the last scattering surface. When you change RS, you have to change that distance to the last scattering surface. So you can think of this as making the observable universe slightly smaller. To do that requires a larger H naught.
From my perspective, what it does, like inflation, it keeps it as opposed to decaying faster, for a little while keeps it constant, and then
Okay. All right. So that's the best theory there is, which says a lot. Okay. As you can probably tell, I'm not a big fan of it, but
before we go there, can I ask something?
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's another mechanism that can actually decrease the sound speed, but what do we need the dark energy? Is it because you said it's after the matter radiation equality, but before the combination, so like the times are
yes.
very small or something?
No, that time is critical because you don't want to mess up what's happening around matter radiation equality. You want this to be in the radiation dominated regime when the acoustic wave is being pushed out with the baryons and forming the peak in the CMB. You don't want it to be there after recombination because you don't want to mess up matter growth. You don't want to mess up the late time universe. So those are the constraints on when it has to happen, basically.
So instead of invoking that, do we know something else that can do the same thing, but it's not, doesn't have enough time to do it? So is that why we put that?
Dream it up.
This is the best we got so far, according to what you said, right?
Yeah.
So this might be to take you off in a different direction, but there's the less exciting answer that what we've discovered is that we've made underestimates of systematic errors in one of our methods.
Yes.
And is that, so you've sort of set that aside and said we're looking at
yes.
the solution.
Yeah, I used to be an advocate for, because I'm an observer, I think there are systematic errors in everything. And I used to just think there is a systematic error. But now it's been so long and so many people have been looking for it, that's kind of like fading a little bit. But that was one of the reasons that I did this work, segue in, because what we are fundamentally doing with our local measurements is we are observing the Hubble parameter in a small patch around us. And we know that the Hubble parameter has some sort of background value, average over all space, but it also has a different value in different patches of the universe. If you took this to the extreme and you had a very dense region here, then this might be behaving like a closed universe that's going to expand to a maximum and collapse down to singularity. And that would obviously have a very different Hubble parameter, present day value of the ratio between the velocity and the distance to the overall background. And if we look at the last scattering surface from the CMB, we're looking actually at the average Hubble parameter over the whole observable universe as it goes into the angular diameter distance, the last scattering surface. But as we're looking locally, we basically push out to as far as we can see with our supernova, which tends to be a scale of around 200 megaparsecs. So what I did with the postdoc was to ask how big the fluctuations are in H-naught. If you looked in spheres of radius 200 megaparsecs in the universe, and could that error explain the tension that we see? The answer is no, and this was known before we started. But what we did do was actually we brought in a whole range of different methods that people had used in observational cosmology to calculate this kind of thing. Because sample variance, as we call this kind of fluctuation, is ubiquitous in observational cosmology. It's one of the things every experiment has to worry about. Patch to patch is what you're seeing representative of the volume as a whole. And we know that the density of the universe has a changes patch to patch. This is the variance. It's an integral over the power spectrum of fluctuations in the universe with some window function. If that window function is a top hat, this will give you the variance of the overdensity in spheres of the radius that you put into this function. So if you use CAM or something to give you the power spectrum of the universe, you can write a very short Python script to tell you what fluctuations in the overdensity should look like of particular scales. And then there are different ways of understanding how the Hubble parameter and other cosmological parameters will vary patch to patch. And we looked at five of them, which had actually been developed in different problems, but all looking at sample variance, but we used all of them to measure this patch-to-patch variation in the Hubble parameter. We found the same result from all of them, that basically for the current supernova data set, which is called Pantheon, this gives fluctuations in H-naught of around plus or minus one, and that is not enough to explain the larger, basically 74 to 68 plus or minus six difference that we now have from supernova to CMB measurements. So let me, in the very short amount of time I have left, just rattle through these. I'll do it reasonably quickly, but I'll try and just give you a feel for how the theory works in terms of going from these fluctuations in overdensity through to fluctuations in the Hubble parameter. Okay. Hopefully, you all know about the spherical top hat model. I use this in my fourth year cosmology course to teach people about linear growth and growth of structure in the universe, because I think it's one of the simplest ways to get through to linear growth. What you have to consider are two spheres of material in the universe containing the same mass. One is slightly overdense. One has the background density at present day, let's say. And as we go back in time, dark energy becomes negligible. This has a slightly different curvature compared to the background. So if we live in a flat universe, the curvature of the background is just basically zero, but this overdensity translates through to a changing curvature. Because of Birkhoff's theorem and assuming some simplifications, such as an isotropic universe around these spheres, you can write down the standard cosmology equations for the spheres, where now X is either the perturbation or the background. And if you go back to early universe, dark energy drops out, you can write down a Friedmann equation where you have a curvature term. If you match these spheres in the early universe, you can get a link between the overdensity that you can get by integrating the power spectrum and the curvature of the patch that then would give rise to that overdensity at late times. Yeah.
Observationally, this translates to peculiar velocities of galaxies or something?
So that's a really good question. If you are in this patch and you analyze it in the frame of this patch, you will not think there are peculiar velocities. Your frame will expand with the expansion of this sphere. But if you look at this sphere and you observe it in the frame of the background, you will say there are peculiar velocities relative to the background of this sphere expanding and collapsing within that frame. So in this way, that expansion is directly linked to peculiar velocities. So this differential expansion of these spheres basically links the curvature early on to this overdensity. And here's just a plot I made of some of these. I mean, once you've got the Friedman equation for these patches, you can evolve them as you like. If the overdensity is sufficiently large, they collapse down. If it's sufficiently small, the curvature is sufficiently small, then they go as the background. These dashed lines are linear theory expansions. If you want linear growth, that's what these dashed lines give you. So that's the linear growth of these perturbations represented by the spheres. But what we can do, having calculated the range of overdensities, we can get a range of basically curvatures. We can plug it into the Friedman-Mott equation. We can evolve these mini universes, spheres, according to the Friedman equation. And that actually gives us, at the same time as our current background time is at present day, we can measure what the Hubble parameter is in each of these different patches, and we can get a range of Hubble parameters for the amplitude of the power spectrum that we now see. Enough of a broad brush picture. You see how the spherical model goes from fluctuations in overdensity through to fluctuations in H naught in these different patches. If we make the patch size the size of the patch covered by the Pantheon supernova sample, we should be able to get what is the sample variance error on H naught measurements. Okay. The classical way for supernova observations of perturbing or understanding where how sample variance comes in is to do a full GR calculation of how perturbations in density affect a luminosity distance measurement. This, I think, was first done in Sasaki in this paper. They basically used a GR framework to look along the line of sight, put perturbations along that line of sight, and looked at how that distance redshift relationship was changing. This has been extended more recently because of the interest in the Hubble tension. And basically, just in my simplified way, you start by calculating the angular diameter distance. Basically, that's related to the luminosity distance that you're interested in. And then the standard GR terms you get, magnification, redshift space distortions. Redshift space distortions is the dominant term. And as you said, that's related to this spherical model. And that's how these are all related. They're just different perturbative ways of looking at the same solution. And ultimately, if you work through, you get a pretty simple relationship between the fluctuation in the Hubble parameter and the overdensity that there is along the line of sight between you and a supernova. That's the classical way of doing sample variance. There's another way. You're all familiar with people running n-body simulations of the universe, hopefully. If you want to run an ensemble of n-body simulations of the universe that looks like an ensemble of patches in the universe, you don't just run all of your simulations with the same fixed cosmological parameters. The volume of the simulation you're running was related to how you should vary the cosmological parameters to give you a set of simulations that actually looks like an ensemble. Within this picture, people have done the same kind of sample variance calculations to work out how they should change the cosmological parameters that they put into their n-body simulations in order to get this ensemble right. There's a big shift because of a background mode, but then there are shifts also in the cosmological parameters that are required. And this paper, Circo 2005, this is the archive number, was perhaps one of the first to do this. And they actually wrote down how you should start off your n-body simulations such that a series of 1,000 of them will look like 1,000 patches in the universe, rather than 1,000 facsimiles of the background without the full variation that is required. The equations look something like this. You start having to have a patch cosmology that's related to your background cosmology. So this is what you would put in your initial conditions file when you were running Gadget or whatever n-body code you wanted to run. This phi is related to the background delta, which is what you would estimate from your power spectrum to start off with. Yeah. Fourth method. Don't think, just use bigger simulations. Always a favored method by many people, myself included. Just run a large simulation, large enough that it has these fluctuations in background within the box already. Then select out patches that are the size of the Pantheon supernova sample. All of this will automatically be taken care of in the simulation. what would be your spherical top hat collapse coming in just now looks like peculiar velocities within the background frame that the simulation is using. You need to balance the size of the simulation that's required to get all the power spectrum modes required and have the resolution to mimic your supernova sample. So supposing you've got enough computer time, you can do this. Fifth method, simulate the simulations. What are you actually doing with the simulations? You've just got a series of points that mimics your supernova sample. Those points are correlated in terms of density, in terms of fluctuations. You can actually write down analytically what those correlations should be. And if you've got 1,000 supernova, you can write down 1,000 by 1,000 covariance matrix that tells you the fluctuations that those supernova should have relative to each other. You can write this down. This gives you a covariance matrix. You can Cholesky decompose it. You can draw numbers from it. You can look again at variations in the H naught parameter from variations in those supernova samples. Okay. And the final result is they all agree to within the errors. They're all perturbative methods, all been developed in different fields, all solving the same sample variance problem. There's nothing to stop you applying them all to this H naught tension problem. And they all give you that for the size that we have of basically the supernova sample that's being used. We should expect changes in H of around plus or minus one compared to the background value. And that doesn't explain the difference that we've got between local measurements of 74 and background measurements of 68. Okay, so that's it. Hubble parameter measurements do not agree with 5 sigma. Many people are worried about this. Many ideas have been tested. Nobody has yet found a solution. Early dark energy, which I have portrayed in probably a more negative way than many people would have done, is the best theory we have. And that really shows where we are. Sample variance was how I recently looked into this and got into this field. It doesn't work. But what was neat, I think, was that, at least it was neat for me, is that I actually understood why a whole range of different analyses that have been brought together to look at fluctuations in the universe in different fields, how they all matched each other and how they all gave a similar result for this problem. Okay, that's me.
Thanks for the wonderful talk. So it's time for questions. Matt?
You could presume, I mean, your conclusions about sample variance are, of course, all based on lambda CDM.
Yes.
So you could wangle out of it if you posited that there was way more power.
Oh, we did that calculation.
Okay.
You need huge amounts of power. You need so much power that tons of other things break. So we tried that. Yeah, sorry, I should say.
Apart from the CMB, what else breaks?
Galaxies. Galaxy surveys just, you know, you need like factors of many at very large scales. It just
5 or something, I would guess, right?
Yeah, so on the previous slide, I just want to understand. So, I mean, you said it was known at the beginning, but had you not known what could have, am I right? What could have happened is that instead of those dots being close together, they could have been broad enough to include shoes.
Yes.
And then that would have been regarded as resolving the problem.
Exactly, yes.
But now this shows that all these things, they're all doing the same, and it's really that this is 5 sigma.
Yeah, yeah. You can't explain it by patch-to-patch variations. And
so
just,
one of the things, the theoretical idea of EDE keeps shoes and moves CMB. Are there any ideas moving shoes that keep CMB?
No, the problem, the shoes is a local measurement, and the problem is this changing things in the local measurement messes everything up. To try to get this not to look like this lambda CDM, this shaded area is the Planck lambda CDM prediction. Trying to change this shape is very difficult because it's not just a measurement of H naught at redshift 0 that we've got at low redshift. It's measurements along this curve, and changing the shape then basically pushes one thing or another out.
So that hasn't. At what point could we consider this discrepancy to be an observation of EDE?
Good question.
It's a semi-rhetorical, of course.
Yes.
So,
I don't know very much about this field, but I was recently told by somebody that possibly the resolution is that the Hughes data is just dirty in the sense that the dust in the host galaxies of quasars, of supernovae, don't give you the magnitudes properly, maybe also for CFIDs. And so your distance ladder is just wrong, and that could just, is that reasonable at all?
It's an option on the table. I'm not a supernova person, so I'm not going to defend against it, but it's an option that people have considered. I mean, people that are more in the field than me have looked into this and said it's not happening, but there is a history of people underestimating their errors in this field.
And also the theory of supernova is not so clear enough. There's so much variation, different kind of supernova, that there could be a lot of misunderstanding of what the practice should be.
There could still be observational problems, yes.
So if you completely exclude the supernova data, to what extent does a tension still exist?
There are other local measurements, particularly strong lensing measurements, that seem to be pushing to a higher value of the Hubble parameter. But with larger error bars, and they're, you know, not yet at the same level of discrepancy.
So probably we should actually, at this point, move on to the second major tension. So